like the time my day job led me to Molly Shannon. I was working one of my countless transcription jobs, but this one was different. Instead of transcribing medical jargon or boring academic lectures, I was a transcriber for the Television Critics Association's annual press event. This event happens every fall in Los Angeles. Every major television network presents their newest lineup of television shows to the Critics Association through a series of press conferences. The producers, directors, and stars for each new television series sit on a stage and answer questions from the press about their show. The hope is that if you dazzle the press with a great presentation, it will create good buzz about your new series. My job was to attend the press conferences, produce a written shorthand account of the panel, and then transcribe the whole thing with the help of an audio tape. We turned over the transcriptions to the press panel, which used them to write their articles. It was an awesome job. I saw a ton of celebrities. I got to sit and listen to industry professionals talk about their work, and I got paid for it. The days were long, 10 to 12 hours. The transcribing part was kind of grueling. They had just one hotel room for all the transcribers to share. They cleared the room of all furniture and replaced it with 10 desks and computers. To say it was cramped was an understatement. You had to keep your elbows in while typing or you would bump your neighbor. Do you know how much heat 10 desktop computers from the late 1990s produce? A lot. We were each assigned 2 to 3 press conferences each day. We got room service for lunch and usually a big plate of cookies for dessert. But the best part of the job was that we were allowed to attend the nightly industry parties at the hotel if we finished our work in time. This blew my mind. The parties were basically made up of 4 types of people. The celebrities / creators of television shows, the press, the network suits, and transcribers who got their work done early. There was live music, people were dressed up, drinks were in hand, hors d'oeuvres were passed. It was exactly how you'd imagine a fancy Hollywood party to be. Now, I've been putting parties in quotes because what I didn't realize at the time was that these weren't really parties. They were work. The celebrities weren't having any fun. How could they be? They were surrounded by reporters holding little tape recorders asking prying questions. The network suits were working hard to impress the television critics so they could promote their shows. And the press was tired. They sat through long days of presentations. And now they were doing their best to get some sort of exclusive quote or scoop, so they had something different to offer than just the same transcription page everyone else got. Everyone was working. Except me. I was done working. I got to stand around and take it all in. I didn't care that it wasn't a real party. I was getting an insider look at the Hollywood machine at work. And I got free food. Of all the parties, the one I most wanted to attend was the Saturday Night Live party. We'd heard a rumor that the whole cast of Saturday Night Live would be there. I desperately wanted to see and maybe even meet some of my comedy idols. The SNL party was an early one. It started at 5 p.m. This caused a dilemma for me because we were only allowed to crash the parties if we had finished our work for the day, and we were never finished by 5 p.m. I had to figure out how to leave work early and sneak into the party without anyone knowing. I needed a better excuse than a lost cat or parking ticket problem. This required something more dramatic. That's when I got my big idea. I decided I would pretend I was sick and ask to go home early, then stop by the party on my way out. It was a bold plan that required a grand performance. I was up for it. After all, I was an actress, wasn't I? The party was on Thursday evening. I began to lay the groundwork for my ruse on Wednesday morning, innocently sniffling while I transcribed in the sweltering hotel room. By Wednesday afternoon, I had upped the drama and was coughing, announcing to my coworkers that I felt achy and congested. It seemed to be working. So on Thursday morning, I went full method actor and wore no makeup to work. In fact, I even put a little yellow cream makeup from my college Benai makeup kit under my eyes to make them look sallow. Oh my God, as I'm reading this, I am realizing how completely crazy I was back then. Upon seeing my appearance, my boss took me aside and said, "Hey, you don't look so good." I said, "Yeah, I've been feeling this come on for a couple of days now, but I think I'm okay. I'll stick it out. Ha-ha! Now that the hook was set, I slowly degraded my condition as the day went on, slouching deeper in my chair and complaining of a headache. It was a shameless performance, but it worked. By 4 p.m., my boss was insisting that I go home and get some rest. I protested a little, but then reluctantly agreed and gathered my things. Feeling like Meryl Streep, I left the hotel and walked to my car, which was parked on a nearby side street. Behind the seat, I had stashed supplies for my transformation. Baby wipes, a makeup bag, a party dress, and heels. I washed my face with the baby wipes, did my makeup, and changed clothes, all while crammed in the passenger seat of my car. Within 15 minutes, I was party ready. As I approached the hotel security, I realized a little detail I hadn't figured out: how to get back into the hotel. There was security everywhere, all charged with the task of protecting the celebrities inside from weirdos attempting to sneak in and bug them. Me. The only way in was through the main entrance, which was just past the crowded red carpet. Again, for security reasons, you couldn't just stroll up to this red carpet. You had to drive up, and cars needed a special access pass to get all the way through. I still had my work pass, but that only got me in the back entrance, a precarious path that would get me discovered. I was stuck. That's when I noticed a long line of limos sitting across from the hotel. I walked up to one of the drivers and asked what he was doing. He said they were paid to drive the celebrities to the events, drop them at the red carpet, and then wait a few hours until they were done. I noticed his access pass in the window and asked him if there was any way he would be willing to drive me up to the red carpet and drop me off. Again, I'm aghast at how nuts I was back then. He smiled and said, "Sure, hop in." He drove me to the entrance and even opened the door for me. What a cool guy. I felt like a star. And that is how I walked my first red carpet. Well, sort of. Here's a little known fact. There are two lanes on every red carpet. The front lane for the celebrities, where the photographers scream their name, and the back lane is for guests and assistants. I guess I wasn't feeling that crazy because I walked the back lane. But nonetheless, I had red carpet under my feet. I felt so fancy, and also so empowered that the limo drop-off ploy had worked. Once in the lobby, I headed directly to the Saturday Night Live party. It was pretty surreal walking into that room, suddenly surrounded by all of my favorite comedians. There I was, sipping a wine spritzer and eating off the same buffet table as Norm MacDonald. It was awesome. As I perused the room, I noticed Molly Shannon was nearby. Jackpot. I loved this woman. She was and still is one of my acting idols, and I wanted so badly to meet her. She was surrounded by press, so I crossed the room and carefully inserted myself into the circle. I stood and waited, nodding along as Molly answered questions. But after waiting a few minutes, I became so desperate to have her notice me that I started cracking jokes. Awful jokes. I vaguely remember a joke about traffic and one about boobs. It was seriously so horrible and cringy and awkward, I can barely think about it without getting hives. It didn't take long before I started getting the evil eye from the reporters. So I finally shut up and listened politely. Eventually, the press walked away, and I seized my chance to have Molly all to myself. I said, "Hi, I'm not really supposed to be here. I'm an aspiring actress new to L.A., and I just wanted to say that I really love what you do." Now, Molly could have just been polite and said, "Thanks, nice to meet you." Or she could have blown me off. After all, I was the weirdo party crasher telling boob jokes. But she didn't. She turned to face me, looked me in the eyes, and said, "Don't give up. Whatever you do, just don't give up, okay?" It took me 10 years to get on SNL. I walked around and no one knew who I was. Then I got on SNL and it all changed overnight. You just never know. So don't give up. 10 years. 10 years. It's hard, okay? Good luck. You can do it. I'm not overstating things when I say that this moment was one of the most important moments of my budding career. I had been in Los Angeles for a very long year, a year that was so hard and personally challenging that I had started to doubt that I could ever make it. But here was Molly Shannon, telling me it took her a decade to get noticed. She's like the funniest, most talented woman ever, and it took her 10 years. Finally, someone who told it like it was. Someone who let me know that even when you have talent, it can take a long time. That an acting career doesn't just happen overnight. It takes time. It takes work. And she told me not to give up. She was now officially my hero. I shook her hand and started walking away, deep in a daze of excitement and inspiration. I was so far gone that I bumped into a fellow partygoer and spilled wine spritzer all over my dress. It was a little embarrassing, clearly my fault. I turned to apologize to the partygoer and was completely shocked to see who it was. My boss. Yep. That boss. The one I had lied to. It turned out the group had decided to take a break and go to the party. All of my coworkers were there, staring at me in a party dress covered in wine spritzer. And not the least bit sick. My boss simply said, "Feeling better?" And I said, "Yeah." Long pause. Then I said, "I'm guessing I should not come in tomorrow." And he said, "You guessed right." So I was fired at the SNL party. And man, was it worth it. That advice from Molly Shannon was so inspirational, it helped me get through the subsequent years of struggle. If I needed a pick-me-up, my mom would get on the phone with me and say, "Just remember what Molly told you, honey. It took her 10 years. Let's cut to 10 years later. I'm at the movie premiere of my film Walk Hard, my first starring role in a major studio film opposite John C. Reilly. My co-stars in the movie, Tim Meadows and Chris Parnell, both from SNL. And guess who came to the premiere to support them? Molly Shannon. At the after party, I went over and told her the story from years ago. I thanked her, full of gratitude. We hugged, and then I pulled a photographer over to get our photo. The trick to surviving the big move and your first year as an actor is finding the secret value of shitty situations. Because, unfortunately, there will be a lot of shitty situations. A common trait among successful working actors is their ability to keep working on their craft no matter what. They do this by viewing the dumpy apartment and crappy day job as an opportunity for access to people and stories outside of their normal routines. They use the experiences. If you have an annoying coworker who's incessantly talking about himself, turn him into a character for your improv class. If you have a painfully long daily commute, use it to practice accents or to listen to podcasts by artists you admire. When you are able to use your experiences to feed your creativity and passion for acting, it doesn't seem as hard. Mining for gold is not easy, but if you do it long enough, you get to be the person who found gold. Chapter 2. Headshots, getting in the union, and building your resume. I didn't get there by wishing for it or hoping for it, but by working for it. Estee Lauder. When I arrived in Los Angeles, my first strategy was to find a film and television agent, also known as a theatrical agent. Between my hours of movie watching, cereal eating, and savings draining, I sent out countless headshots to theatrical agents along with letters asking for an introductory meeting. It seemed like the right thing to do. After all, agents are the portal to auditions, and auditions are the portal to jobs. So the least I could do was get myself an agent, right? Well, it seemed easy on paper, but the reality was a frustrating saga of disappointment. I was talented. I was trained. Why couldn't I get these agents to meet with me? Well, first off, I had barely any experience, and I wasn't in the Screen Actors Guild. Most agents will not take on non-union clients because they can't get them professional work. My only credits were from college and summer stock theater, which basically mean nothing to an agent in Hollywood. Still, I thought an agent would look at my resume and see my potential. Isn't that the story I'd heard my whole life? The talented unknown actor is discovered by an enthusiastic agent who nurtures her and slowly turns her into a megastar? Yeah, it's not that easy, Jenna. Not in the real world. In the real world, agents want to make money. There's a reason it's called show business. Agents are very selective about their clients. And they have to be, because they only make money if the client makes money. They get 10% of an actor's salary, so if you aren't in a position to make them money, they aren't interested. Such are the demands of their job. Good agents, the ones who are plugged in and successful, need an actor who is ready to work. So let's get you ready to work. Step 1. Headshots. Headshots. Every actor needs them, and every actor dreads them. So what are headshots, anyway? They're exactly what the name implies, a photo of your head. Sounds rather cold and clinical, doesn't it? Perhaps that's why actors hate getting them. It took me several attempts before I felt like I'd really nailed it. For a long time, I didn't know the qualities that made up a good headshot. I thought it was as simple as wearing my favorite outfit and picking the prettiest picture of me. Oh, it is so much more than that. Your headshot is the first thing an agent or casting director will see of you, so it must stand out from the sea of hundreds they look at every day. When going through headshot submissions, they flip through them very quickly, so your picture needs to pop. The next time you're in a grocery store, head on over to the cereal aisle and look at all the different cereal boxes. Many of them are virtually identical to one another in terms of ingredients, so cereal companies have to rely on other factors to grab your attention. This is why they've spent millions of dollars on packaging. If acting is the business, you are the product, and your headshot is the packaging. You can be the most talented actor on the planet, but if you have a crappy headshot, you may never get the chance to show off your chops. My first and best piece of advice for getting a good headshot is to hire a professional headshot photographer. Don't use your friend, your smartphone, your dad, or the portrait studio at Sears for your headshot photo. You must have a professional photographer who specializes in taking headshots. Model shots and portraits are something else entirely. You want professional headshots. Your headshot needs to look like you. This advice probably seems obvious, but you would be surprised at how many actors have headshots that vaguely resemble themselves. A good headshot conveys how you look on a regular day, not your best day. It's not a glamour shot. It should just be you. Not the prettiest or most handsome version of you, or the youngest or the sexiest. You just want it to be you. Just good old, regular you. Casting directors expect you to look as advertised. If you have a beard when you take your headshots, be prepared to be an actor with a beard. If you cut or color your hair, you'll need new headshots to match your new look. If you're wearing glasses in your headshot, you better wear them to the audition, too. Back when I was a struggling actor, I would usually go to auditions after being at work most of the day. Most likely, I'd have to drive across town, which meant sitting in traffic for about an hour in a car that had no air conditioning. Usually, I'd drive with the windows down, which meant I'd sweat through my clothes while my hair was blown into a ratty, tangled mess. Once I arrived, I'd change clothes in my car and attempt to pull myself together using my rearview mirror, a portable curling iron, and wet wipes. My headshot had better not be glamorous. This brings me to my best piece of advice regarding headshots, compliments of my friend, casting director Mara Casey. Know what you are selling. Mara was the casting director for the television show Gilmore Girls, among other productions. She has looked at thousands of headshots and seen both the good and the bad. When I asked her, she said her biggest headshot pet peeves occur when she receives a headshot in which the actor is A, looking away from camera, B, covered in shadows, or C, making a funny face. Just look honestly into the lens. If that feels vulnerable, then be vulnerable. But don't try to ham it up or be artsy. Just be you. But most importantly, know what you are selling. Mara suggests picking 5 adjectives that best describe the kind of characters you might easily play. And then ask yourself, does your headshot convey those 5 adjectives? I know what you might be thinking. I can play anything. I'm a trained actor. But acting in the entertainment business is about typecasting and gut reactions, especially when you are starting out. If you look naturally sweet and naive in real life, you aren't going to be cast as a drug-addicted career criminal. You just aren't. At least not at first. Trust me, I tried. You need to have a headshot that easily typecasts you. A great way to figure out your five adjectives is to ask friends, relatives, your agent, we'll get to finding one in chapter 3, or even people who don't know you very well, what adjectives they would use to describe their first impression of you. Try to get a headshot that matches those adjectives. Jenna Fisher, A History and Headshots. Okay, it's my turn to get vulnerable. And when you see my first headshots, you'll see why. I wasn't lying when I said it took me years to figure this stuff out. Ready for some mistakes? P.S. You can see these and all the other photos mentioned in the book in the downloadable PDF that comes with this audiobook. My first headshot was an adorably earnest photo of my smiling face. I was 21 years old, but looked about 15. I had short curly hair and a chip in my front tooth, which I didn't get fixed until after I had the headshot taken. It was taken by my tech professor in my college theater department, Ron Ribkowski. He was an awesome teacher, and every year he would take headshots for any juniors or seniors that wanted them, for free. He hung a backdrop with nice lighting and took a few simple photos of each student. What five things did my first headshot tell you about me? Hi, I'm new in town. I have curly hair. I'm not a professional actress. I like thick sweaters. Did I mention I'm new? I'd like to remind you that this is the headshot of a person who fully believed she was going to be a rich and famous actor within 6 months of living in L.A. Okay, Jenna. I used this headshot when I auditioned for Summerstock Theater. I used it to get meetings with commercial casting agents when I first arrived in Los Angeles, and I used it to submit myself for student films. For a free headshot, that's not too bad. But I quickly realized it was not the best advertisement for my business. I had to get new ones. So I did. And wow. What did I learn? The word nothing comes to mind. In many ways, the new photo was a step backward. I used a professional headshot photographer in Los Angeles, but I refused to listen to any of her advice. Of the hundreds of photos we took that day, I was certain that the best photo was the one of me clutching my knees and a pair of overalls covering my whole body. Even though the photographer told me it wasn't her favorite, I insisted this was the one. This is a very good example of why you should not pick your headshot photo. In fact, here is a list of people who should not help you pick your headshot photo. You. Your husband slash boyfriend slash girlfriend slash wife. Your best friend. Your mom slash dad slash sister slash brother. You shouldn't pick it because you will not be able to put vanity aside, and all those other people will not be able to see you as a sellable commodity. The following are people who should help you pick a headshot photo. The photographer. Teachers. Friends who aren't your best friend. Fellow acting students. Industry professionals such as a casting director, agent, or producer. People at your day job. Strangers. Let them tell you what your best headshot is and trust it. Just don't pick it yourself. You can't be objective. Moving on. After realizing the overalls weren't working, I got yet another headshot. I decided to wear jeans and a black sweater for this one, but seriously, this is the goofiest photo of me. What was I doing? What is happening? Why am I perched on a stool? Why is my sweater tucked into my jeans? I should say, in my defense, I did not send this one out, but I did print it. I felt so strongly about it that I had it printed as an option. You see, back when I was starting out, headshots were shot on film, and you got contact sheets full of the hundreds of shots from your session. You had to look at them with a little magnifying scope because they were printed really tiny. If you wanted a larger version, you had to pay $10 per 8x10 to blow them up. Because money was tight, I typically chose 3 or 4 of my favorites from the contact sheet to be blown up. And then I showed these full-size versions to everyone I knew and got their opinion as to which one should become my new headshot. Now do you see why you shouldn't pick your own headshots? I wasted $10 because I wanted to see this full size. Thank God I had friends to talk me out of it. Time passed, and nothing happened. My hair was getting longer. I wanted to shake things up, so I decided to get a new headshot. I scheduled a session. No joke, I wore the overalls again. And I'm sitting in the same closed-off way as the other overalls headshot. Until I started going through my old headshots and looked at them side by side, I could not fully appreciate the insanity of this decision. Why was I so attached to those overalls? Do I still have them? I'm afraid if I go look in my closet, I may still have them. There was absolutely nothing strategic going on in my photos. It was just me, in what was clearly my favorite outfit, smiling. This brings me to a very interesting part of my history with headshots. Using the overalls headshot, somehow I got an agent. I don't know how or why. In spite of my refusal to wear anything remotely flattering while posing for headshots, I got an agent. Again, more about this in Chapter 3. Guess what? He didn't love my headshot. Upon signing me, he insisted I get new ones. He suggested I use a popular photographer who was known for providing professional styling and makeup on his shoots. So I took his advice, and I got what might be my favorite photo of me ever taken. I loved this photo. I still love this photo. I look feisty, fierce, powerful, and even sexy. I'd never had anyone capture me in a photo like this before. I loved this idea of me. I got a lot of auditions with this headshot, but what I didn't get was a lot of jobs. And to know why, we must go back to Mara Casey's advice, knowing what you're selling. Clearly, I didn't know. I'm not this girl. I got a lot of auditions followed by a lot of rejection and disappointment. I wasn't getting called in for the roles I was really right for because my headshot communicated fierce, sexy girl, and I walked in wearing my ridiculous overalls. You might be thinking, burn the damn overalls already! Wear something sexy to the audition! But remember, I hired professional hair and makeup for this photo shoot. There was no way I could recreate that look, mood, feeling on my own. Not in my Mazda after a day of transcribing medical jargon. By the way, I'm not against using makeup artists for photo shoots. I actually think it's a great idea. There are ways they can apply makeup that looks natural but also makes your eyes pop or evens out your skin tone. It just has to be subtle. While my agent loved that sexy shot, my manager suggested I do a reshoot. We searched for a photographer that specialized in photographing comedic actors. But instead of just booking a session, I decided to finally think critically about my headshot and figure out what I'm selling. After a lot of consideration, I came up with my 5 adjectives. Sweet, trustworthy, open, cute, and vulnerable. I was able to communicate these to the photographer before the shoot. And that's when I got the perfect headshot. Finally, I did it. I figured out what I was selling. And the shot focused on my face and eyes. No more silly overalls, no more corny poses. I figured out what I was selling. Once again, my 5 adjectives were sweet, trustworthy, open, cute, and vulnerable. I'm not sure you quite got vulnerable out of the picture, but I think I hit the other 4 pretty well. This is the headshot that got me called into my audition for Pam on The Office, which makes sense because this is how the casting notice described the character. Pam Beasley, 26 to 29. Pam is the receptionist and Jim's friend. Pam is decent, reasonable, and friendly. She has the manner of a nice kindergarten teacher or a future mom. She is an ordinary woman with a sense of humor. She allows her loudish boss to push her around some, but can exhibit flashes of working-class toughness in protecting her friends. She's not cynical or a smartass, although her way of disagreeing is a gentle sarcasm. She's not arrogant or glamorous or overtly sexy, but she is cute compared to the other office workers, and she loves to play with Jim, who understands her better than Roy, her fiancé. They have become true friends, and their flirting is more serious than they acknowledge. Pam needs to be soft and kind and vulnerable. Pam is the romantic lead. The adjectives used to describe Pam were decent, friendly, soft, cute, kind, and vulnerable. Can you imagine what would have happened if my agent had sent my old headshot, the one with the Angelina Jolie pout and heavy eyeliner? I may have never been called to audition. Recently, I was talking with Allison Jones, the casting director from The Office. I told her I was writing this book on the acting business and was currently working on a section about headshots. She said, "Oh, Jenna, I still remember your headshot from when you came in for The Office. It was so good. It was so you, so Pam." Now that's a good headshot. Over a decade later, and she still remembers it. And that's another thing to keep in mind. Not only does your headshot need to get you in the door, it's also what's left behind so they can remember you. I recommend getting your headshots once you've arrived in New York, Los Angeles, or Chicago, as photographers living in these cities will know current industry standards. For example, when I was starting out, the industry standard was black and white. Every actor had black and white headshots, except for redheads. Isn't that funny? If you were a redhead, you needed a color headshot to show off your red hair. These days, everyone is expected to have a color headshot. Sorry, redheads, you don't get to corner the market anymore. In general, at the time of this book's publication, the going rate for a good Los Angeles or Chicago headshot photographer is around $400 to $650. This rate includes 2 to 3 different looks, plus 2 to 3 retouched final images. The rate in New York is a little higher, around $500 to $875. This doesn't include the cost of a professional makeup artist or the printing of your photos, which combined will run you another $200 to $300. I know, it's not cheap, especially when you're struggling. As you can clearly see, I didn't get it right the first time, or the second, or even the third. And it will probably take you a few sessions to figure out how to get the best photo as well. Very few people end up loving their first headshots. After all, we aren't models. I managed to get an agent and work even with my less than ideal headshots, so don't freak out if you feel like you aren't mastering it right away. All you need is one decent photo to get you started. So make the best of your session, use the 5 adjectives, and try to have some fun. Step 2. Getting in the union. When an actor tells you the story of how they got their SAG-AFTRA card, it usually starts with a deep sigh, followed by a long, drawn-out story that sounds almost as exciting as a trip to the dentist. This is because you cannot get a professional acting job unless you are in the union, but you cannot get into the union unless you have a professional acting job. A textbook catch-22. It took me 3 years to get my union card, and I consider my journey one of the easier ones. The 2 most popular ways to get into SAG-AFTRA are performing in television commercials or doing extra work. First, let's discuss commercials. Commercials. If you book a union commercial job, you gain access to the union. Instantly, boom, you're in. Because unlike film and television work, you don't need to be a member of SAG-AFTRA to book a role in a union commercial. You also don't need much experience, because oftentimes, commercials are more about the look of an actor. But what you do need is a commercial agent. You might be thinking, hold up, Jenna. At the beginning of this chapter, you said I wasn't ready to look for an agent. True. I did say that. But I was referring to a theatrical agent. Commercial agents are different. Commercial agents only submit their clients for work in commercials. Like theatrical agents, commercial agents receive 10% of whatever you earn from commercial work. These agents usually have higher client lists than theatrical agents, mainly because commercial agents pretty much pack their files with as many fresh, interesting faces as they can find, and then they play the numbers game. This means it's generally easier to find a commercial agent than a theatrical agent. The catch is you need to find a good commercial agent to work with. And this can be harder than you might think. Take, for example, my friend Paul's first experience with a commercial agent. Upon arriving in LA, Paul immediately set out to find a commercial agent. He sent his headshot around town and within a week was signed by an agency. Woohoo! He was thrilled. Did it really matter that the commercial agent opted to meet him at a cafe instead of her office? Apparently not to Paul, because he took his buddies out to a bar to celebrate. Three cheers for Paul! Drink up! The next morning, or afternoon, he woke up to an epic hangover. He felt awful, like the bottom of a shoe. But the hangover became tolerable when he remembered the good news. He had a commercial agent. He got up and called her. No answer. He tried again. The phone seemed to be disconnected. Weird. He decided to drive on over to her office, which turned out to be an apartment. After ringing the doorbell a few dozen times, a neighbor came out and told Paul that his new commercial agent had been evicted. He started the process over, and eventually, he got one with an office. My favorite story involving a search for a good commercial agent comes from my friend Ainsley. Over the course of 7 years, she has had 6 different commercial agents. 6! How did she burn through so many agents so quickly? Well, her first agent left the business without telling her. The second one died. The third one never sent her on a single audition. Her fourth agent, wait for it, died. The fifth agent dropped her because they felt she was too plain. Ouch. Exhausted from all the rejection and fed up with the revolving door of agents, Ainsley basically gave up on a career in commercials. But a few years later, a coworker happened to show Ainsley's materials to a friend who was a successful commercial agent. The agent was taken with Ainsley. She loved that Ainsley had a baby face, was from the Midwest, and was not stick thin. She agreed to represent her. A smart choice, as Ainsley went on to book 7 national commercials within the first year of signing. Talk about an exercise in patience that finally paid off big time. After 5 months of mass mailing my smiling headshot to every commercial agent in town, eventually I got signed to a top commercial agency. It felt pretty good to sign with them, like things were falling into place. I was confident I'd book a commercial in no time and finally get into the union. Well, like almost everything in Hollywood, it's not that easy. Finding a commercial agent is only the first step. After that, you've got to actually book a commercial, which proved to be much more difficult. I found commercial auditions particularly hard to navigate because they often involved no scripted lines. I was a trained actor. I was used to delivering dialogue and playing characters. Commercial auditions seemed to be mostly about improvisation and appearance. One of my first commercial auditions was as a young, frazzled housewife for a new kitchen floor cleaner. I asked my agent how I should prepare. She told me not to worry. I get all the instructions when I arrived at the audition. This is pretty common with commercials. It's rare to receive any materials prior to the day of the audition. I decided to arrive a half hour early so I could look over the materials and practice. I was expecting to see some sort of dialogue sheet about my messy kitchen floor that was magically transformed after using XYZ product. But when I got there, I saw nothing. Only a sign-in sheet next to a little cartoon drawing of the commercial. I signed in and didn't give it much thought. When I went into the room, the casting director asked me to state my name to the camera and then said, "If you could go anywhere in the world, where would you go and why?" Random, not sure what that had to do with floor cleaner. I was upbeat and friendly. "My name is Jenna Fisher. If I could go anywhere in the world, I'd like to go on safari in Africa and pet baby lions." Okay, not the most witty response, but it was the truth. However, clearly the truth wasn't enough because I didn't get the part. In fact, I never got the part. I went on countless commercial auditions and never booked a single one. Zero. Recently, an acting student told me that she goes on commercial auditions all the time that ask for a Jenna Fisher type. Ironic, right? When Jenna Fisher was auditioning for commercials, no one was interested. To help you, I decided to ask some experienced commercial actors for their advice, since I'm clearly not a master of the commercial audition process. My friends all said the same thing. Study the storyboards. A storyboard is a template created by the advertising agency that tells the shot-by-shot story of the commercial. They basically look like a comic strip, and you usually find them hanging on the wall by the sign-in sheet. Aha! That little cartoon from the floor cleaner audition. If you take a moment to absorb them, they will explain your role in the spot, as well as the overall energy and tone of the commercial. Advertisers sweat over each word and visual when creating a storyboard because they only have 30 seconds to sell their product. So storyboards need to be precise. Your job is to really study the storyboard and absorb it, then go into the room and recreate it. Show the advertisers that you're the guy from the storyboard. Another piece of advice from my expert friends? Next time you're watching television, actually watch the commercials. You'll notice that in most ads, the actors don't say anything at all. Commercials tend to be a series of images with a narrator's voice laid on top. Sure, sometimes the actors talk, but it's usually just a few words. What's more important is what they're doing and how they're doing it. Understanding this nuance can be really helpful. Because when you're called into the audition room and asked some random question about your favorite vacation spot, it doesn't really matter what you say. What matters is that you convey the tone of the commercial. If the commercial is about a frazzled housewife freaking out over her soiled floor, but you present a chipper, upbeat attitude, chances are you're not getting a callback. Don't worry about being likable unless the commercial asks for likable. You want to convey the energy of the commercial in every aspect of your audition, from the way you enter the room to the way you introduce yourself to how you answer questions or say your lines. After he found a good commercial agent with an actual office, my friend Paul got called to audition for a commercial about car insurance. His audition group had 6 people, all clumped together in a tiny room. They were told to be angry and annoyed that the insurance company wouldn't open their doors to deal with their questions. Paul was put at the end of the group next to a particularly obnoxious actor who kept elbowing his way into the shot. Paul was annoyed. He spent the entire audition pissed off and frustrated by this upstaging buffoon. He left the audition and drove home thinking, "I can't believe I drove all the way to Venice for that." Well, imagine his surprise when he booked the job. Upon talking to the director on the day of the shoot, Paul was told they loved how angry and annoyed he was in his audition, that he conveyed the perfect amount of frustration. Ha! Thanks to the buffoon, Paul didn't have to act. He just had to be. Which brings me to the final important piece of advice from the commercial gurus. You are not the star of the commercial. The actor's job in a commercial is to be a supporting player for the real star of the spot, the product. Just act naturally and don't put on a big show. Be there for the product and be real. Be a real car buyer confused about mortgage rates. A real father proud of his son's first home run. A real mom diapering her first child. Real, real, real. That's the mantra of commercials. Extra work. Have you ever wondered about the people dancing in the background of a wedding reception while Owen Wilson flirts with Rachel McAdams? Or how about the ones running hysterically from a falling meteor behind Tom Cruise? Well, if you haven't, let me enlighten you. Those are called extras. Hollywood couldn't tell stories without them. Pretty much anyone off the street can be an extra. You don't need training, you don't need a headshot, you don't need an agent, and you don't have to be in the union. In fact, if you do enough work as an extra, you can actually earn your way into the union. That's how I did it. Here's how it works. Big union productions hire both union and non-union extras to work on their projects. If they haven't met their quota of union extras, or if the work requires a special skill that only a non-union person can perform, they will bump up non-union extras to be union extras for the day. When this happens, you receive a union pay rate, and more importantly, you get a voucher. A voucher is a production time card that verifies your union-level work for the day. Once you've earned 3 vouchers, you become eligible to join the union. But before you get too excited, keep in mind that you will most likely have to work many non-union jobs before you're lucky enough to be bumped up. If you're curious about how a set works, being an extra is a great way to observe the action. However, I should warn you, there are a few downsides to being an extra. It's not, glamorous. In fact, it's pretty grueling. Unless you enjoy being packed into a makeshift tent with no heat or air conditioning, waiting with dozens of other people as they light the set and rehearse with the actors. Also, there are never enough chairs for everyone, so perhaps you'll find it fun to sit on the ground. But to be honest, it hardly matters because the chairs are cheap and uncomfortable anyway. The restroom is usually a porta potty. Yay, ladies! And if they do offer you food, it's most likely something bought in bulk at Costco. Tip: pack your own snacks, water, and lunch. And bring a book, because there's probably no Wi-Fi. I got my first job as an extra on my third day in Los Angeles. I was so excited. I had barely unpacked, and I already had a job. A friend of mine from college worked at Central Casting and heard about a commercial shoot for a new ride at Universal Studios in which non-union extras would earn $100 for the day because it required some stunts. Whatever that meant, we didn't know. We didn't care. This was double the usual non-union rate, so we jumped at the chance. We heard rumors that we might even earn a voucher. Everything about the job seemed amazing. It was at Universal Studios, and we were given special passes to drive on the lot and park. This was particularly exciting because I had never been on a studio lot before. As we walked from our car to the shoot location, we passed by a variety of old movie sets, including the downtown street used in Back to the Future. I couldn't believe it. I was walking past the clock tower. And then we saw Arnold Schwarzenegger playing basketball outside one of the sound stages. Are you kidding me? I had only been in town 3 days, and I was already on a studio lot practically hanging out with the Terminator. My friend and I were giddy and excited. We couldn't stop laughing and talking about our great luck. When we got to the set, we learned that the shoot was a commercial for a new roller coaster water ride based on the movie Jurassic Park. We were loaded into a little boat and told where to look and when to scream. The boat took off, and we laughed and screamed as we sped through the water, passing all sorts of giant dinosaurs. Then, at the end of the ride, the boat climbed up a giant hill and careened at breakneck speed, ending in a giant splash. It was really fun. We laughed and smiled as the little boat glided through the water and the ride started again. Laugh, point, scream! Even the second time it was fun. Again, after it was over, we laughed and smiled as the little boat glided through the water and the ride started again. And again after that. And again after that. We rode the Jurassic water ride for 12 hours. Let me say that again. We rode the Jurassic water ride for 12 hours. But that's not all. To make the rides seem more dramatic, they had men with hoses spraying us with water along the way. Warm water? Nope. The water was freezing cold. This went on and on until we were all very sad. And then, at the end of the day, just when we thought it couldn't get any worse, they brought out the water cannon. Apparently, they needed close-ups. So they shot the water cannon over and over again, pelting each of us as we cowered in fear. Real fear. We weren't pretending anymore. The water cannon was as terrifying as a real dinosaur. The man sitting next to me started crying a little to himself. I think he'd been getting the worst of the water cannon. I realized this because on the very next shot, just as the water cannon boomed, he leaned far back in his seat. As a result, I got blasted in the face with a giant, icy cold water cannonball. It hurt. It was torture. Seriously, the CIA should consider the Jurassic method because by the end, I was ready to name names, any name, to get off that damn ride. My friend and I barely spoke as we walked back to our car after the shoot. We were soaking wet, starving, and completely shell-shocked. We didn't earn a SAG voucher, and we'd only made $100. Even now, when my family comes to town and wants to go to Universal Studios, I can't ride that ride. Last time I checked, they still play parts of the commercial as you stand in line for the ride. If you pause it just right, you can see half of my wet face screaming at a dinosaur. My best experience as an extra was in a commercial for a new long-distance phone service. It was a big-budget commercial, and I was playing a member of a field hockey team. The shoot was about 2 hours' drive out of town, which meant we got to stay in a hotel overnight, all expenses paid. It felt like a mini paid vacation. And the shoot was simple. While the lead girl talked about long distance, I stood in the background with the other girls pretending we were at field hockey practice. It was perfect. I was well fed, I liked the other girls, and I made something like $1,200 in 2 days. And I got a voucher toward being in the union. It was a long way from the Jurassic disaster. After countless other crappy background assignments, I finally got my additional vouchers working as an extra in the movie Pleasantville, starring Reese Witherspoon and Tobey Maguire. I got a call from Central Casting saying that they needed people with a certain look, described as innocent 1950s teenager, for a 2-week job. They wanted people over 18 to look young so they didn't have to pay for chaperones and tutors or work child hours, which are shorter than a normal workday. Well, I told you about my first headshot. I could definitely play under 18. I was told there would be a good chance I could earn vouchers on this project, but to choose me, they would need to see me in person. The set was in the desert, about an hour outside of Los Angeles. I didn't care. I needed those vouchers. I drove my hot car with the broken air conditioner straight into the desert. Lucky for me, I looked young enough. I got to go through full hair, makeup, and wardrobe and be transformed into a 1950s malt shop teen. It was so fun. I felt like a real working actor. Of the 10 days I worked on the project, I think I was only called to the set 3 times. Twice for a malt shop scene and once to stand on the street. But both times I got to see Reese Witherspoon and Tobey Maguire working. It was so cool. The best part of the Pleasantville job was that by the end of the shoot, I had finally earned the additional vouchers I needed to join SAG. I was now a union gal. How to find work as an extra. So, how do you sign up to be an extra? The top extras casting agency is Central Casting. Registration is free, and productions are always looking for new people. Central Casting has offices in New York, Los Angeles, Atlanta, and New Orleans. The process for registering is easy. Simply visit a Central Casting office where you will be photographed and asked to fill out a W-4 form. I would suggest arriving early. The registration lines are long, and they only accept a certain amount of people per day. If you don't make it in the room, you have to come back the next day and start all over again. There are no auditions for background work. Once registered, you call a hotline each morning to see if there's work that matches your type. You must call early. The jobs are first come, first serve. Central Casting offers several workshops about extra work taught by industry professionals. If you are new to the business, take these workshops. They are free and will teach you what to expect as a background performer. They also explain the voucher system and pay structure for non-union and union extra work. Taft-Hartley. A very rare way to gain access to the SAG-AFTRA union is a little loophole called Taft-Hartley. If you are lucky enough to gain access to an audition for a speaking role in a union film or television show, and if you beat out all of the union actors for the job, the production company can submit a Taft-Hartley form to SAG-AFTRA requesting your immediate inclusion in the union. You pay your dues, and you're in. In my experience, getting a Taft-Hartley is as rare as winning the lottery. Most of the time, it's used for instances where a very specific set of attributes are needed. For example, 6-foot-tall blonde female who speaks fluent Japanese, something that simply cannot be filled by a union actor. In my 20 years of being in Los Angeles, I only know one person who ever got a Taft-Hartley into the union. But that is changing due to a little something called the web series. Web series. The newest way to gain membership in the union is to get cast in, or create your own, new media show or web series. Creating a union-eligible web series might sound like a major undertaking, but it could be worth the trouble. To become eligible, your project must have 3 things. A script, a budget, and at least 1 current and qualified SAG-AFTRA cast member. You will be required to fill out a bunch of forms, all of which can be found at www.sag.org. If SAG approves your preliminary form, you will be sent a Station 12 form, which asks you to list all of the performers in your project, both union and non-union. It is at this time that you, as the producer, can request a Taft-Hartley for you, the actor, and get yourself into the union. Pretty sneaky, right? The kicker is that you actually have to film the series and post the results. But that's a good thing, right? I know people who have done this with budgets as low as $300. However, a more realistic budget would probably land in the $1,000 to $5,000 range. You will need to feed your crew, purchase props and costumes, and most likely rent a small lighting package or camera. You'll also have to pay your union actors. Remember, you're going to have to post this on the internet. It will be the beginning of your body of work. You want it to be good. When it comes to getting in the union, you just have to try anything and everything you can to get in. Don't get discouraged. Everyone has a different story, a different path. You may end up riding a theme park ride in hopes of earning a voucher, or perhaps you book a commercial. It's not a perfect science, so you should try every angle. A brief note about scams. Yes, they do happen, so be alert. There are two primary ways that people try to scam new actors looking for work as an extra. Scam alert number one. A real voucher cannot be purchased. Anyone claiming they can sell you a SAG-AFTRA voucher is a scam artist. You must have a time card with your name on it. When you receive a voucher, you will always also receive a pay stub. This is how SAG-AFTRA knows it's legit. Scam alert number two. Beware of companies claiming to provide you with extra work for a monthly fee. This monthly fee is called fee for services, and it is not likely to get you work. Many such companies target people living outside New York and Los Angeles. A legitimate casting service does not charge for finding people work. They get paid by the studio, not by you. Becoming SAG-AFTRA eligible. After you've collected three vouchers, been given a Taft-Hartley, or once you've been cast in a union commercial, you will become SAG-AFTRA eligible. This means you're qualified to join the union at any time. However, before you rush your checkbook down to the SAG-AFTRA office, you might want to check the financial commitment. The current rate to join SAG-AFTRA is $3,000. After paying the initial fee, you are required to pay an annual base fee of $206 plus work dues, which is 1.575% of your SAG earnings. Also, once you join the union, you are not allowed to work non-union jobs anymore. This includes some web series and internet content, so be careful. You can be fined or even thrown out of the union if you're caught working on projects outside of the union's jurisdiction. My advice is to reap the benefits of being SAG-AFTRA eligible. During this transitional time, you are allowed to pursue both union and non-union work, which is important for building your resume. When I was in this position, I created two resumes, one that said I was SAG-AFTRA and one that said I was non-union, both of which were essentially true. Being in this unique situation, I was able to submit myself for all kinds of work. After securing a few more non-union roles, I eventually booked a two-line role in a union film starring Rob Lowe. I raced down to the SAG-AFTRA offices and paid my initiation fee. Joining the unions is expensive, but in return, members gain access to professional work, better pay through salary requirements, residual payments, pension and health coverage, and protection from abusive work conditions. Step 3. Gain experience and build your resume. Let's say you've taken my advice. You've trained, acquired great headshots, and are working to get in the union. There's only one more detail to work on, your resume. Ideally, you want your resume to communicate two things, experience and training. Training is easy enough to get on your own. Experience is a lot harder. When you're first starting out, your experience will be somewhat limited, so you'll need to get creative in order to build your resume. Forget about studio films and network television. Those will come down the road. Right now, focus on student films, short films, independent features, web shows, and industrial films. If you've ever worked in fast food and been made to watch a video about how to use the fryer, That's an industrial film. Basically, anything that puts you in front of a camera doing acting work. You've got to hustle. And by the way, get used to hustling, because here's a dirty secret about the business that no one ever tells you. Even after you get an agent, you still have to hustle. In fact, even after you've been on an iconic television show for 9 years, you still have to hustle. It's very rare to get into a position where the work continually flows to you. My first resume, the one I attached to the photo